Good evening. So I don't often pick the hymns, but more often than not, it seems, whoever picks them, they seem to pick pretty good ones that fit with the themes I'm touching on. So the first and last hymns particularly jive with a lot of the ideas that I have to present to you all tonight. And Elijah, at least I find, is a rather enticing study because he's such an exciting prophet. Like, you think of Elijah, and you think of the miracles of Elijah, and the fact that he had very human struggles, like us, helps us, I think, to be able to deal with our own struggles, because we see how Elisha works through Elijah. I might do that a few times. Elijah. Not Elisha, Elijah. Helps us to work through those same kinds of struggles. But we also see in Elijah a man of, well, he was under a lot of extremes, or I should say extreme circumstances, very unlike us. I've never experienced being on the top of a mountain watching prophets cut themselves with knives. This is not a normal thing that we experience. These circumstances were very different, are very different to what we know as life, day-to-day life. His daily life was quite different. Although he had long periods where we're not quite sure what he was doing. There seemed to be at least 3 years or so between when he first goes to Ahab and tells him there's not going to be any rain to when he finally comes back and meets with Obadiah, who manages the palace, and then appears again to Ahab, and then subsequently everything happens on Mount Carmel. But I'm getting ahead of myself. So what I'd like to do to start off is present a little bit of an outline of some of the ideas that I have concerning Elijah, because and I titled this Elijah Studies because this is the first of a number, because I haven't finished yet. And I hope to present some of these types of themes and consider the following types of considerations, or present these things. And some of the things that occur and might occur to you, that occurred to me, there's so much to consider with the life of Elijah. The obvious thing is the events of his life. And they are very memorable events. Yet, when we look at it, we see Elijah as a prophet that stands out, yet there aren't very many chapters about him compared to, say, Jeremiah, who wrote an entire book. Yet everyone is quite aware of how he performed the miracle of the oil and the flour for the widow of Zarephath, and raised his son from the dead. And these are remarkable things. And fire from heaven was called down at Mount Carmel. And then Ahab runs ahead. Elijah runs ahead of Ahab to Jezreel after that. And then Elijah calls down fire again from heaven, and this time on Ahaziah, who was Ahab's son, and the new king, on his men, groups of 50 men. And then at the end of his life, or the end of the record, as we know it, he divides the River Jordan with his cloak. And those are just a few of the miracles of Elijah. And then we might consider the influence of Elijah as a prophet and a man, and in considering him as a man, we can't help but look at his character and see what kind of man he is. And hopefully this will help us to look at ourselves, to see what kind of people we are. There's a lot to consider, and it's not just an eventful life that Elijah had. Because Elijah comes up in the New Testament as well. He can be compared to other prophets, and I'd like to consider at least three comparisons to Elisha, who succeeds him, to Moses, and to Christ. And Elijah even comes up in the end times. In fact, he's referenced, the name Elijah is referenced all over Scripture, in 1 Kings and 2 Kings, in Chronicles, in Ezra, in Malachi, in all four Gospels, Elijah's name comes up, and in Romans and in James. All over Scripture. And that by itself is reason enough to go, okay, well, Elijah must mean something because it is repeated so many times. And there is yet another good reason to take a little bit closer look at Elijah's role in Scripture and hopefully learn something about our own walk. So hopefully that's helped to set the scene and not to confuse. So when does all this happen? Well, Elijah, of course, comes in around the reign of Ahab. Now, the timing of everything is not always very clear. In fact, if you look at chapter 17, it just has Elijah arriving on the scene. It doesn't say in the fourth year of the king of King Ahab, and it doesn't say any of that. It just says he comes and he makes a statement. And I'll comment further on that in a minute. But then in verse 7, it says sometime later, or a while, some time had passed. In verse 7, the brook dried up, and then he goes to the widow Zarephath. And then again, verse 17, sometime later, or after those things, the son of the woman who owned the house became ill. And then even in chapter 18, there's no date. It just says, after a long time, in the third year. I won't comment on that third year at this point. I'll leave that for another time. But it's hard to pin down an exact date. Ahab reigns for 22 years, we know this, which is in the end of chapter 16. So Elijah appears to enter near the beginning of Ahab's reign, although not too near the beginning, because he first has had time to do a few things in direct rebellion to God. He's married Jezebel, and he's set up Baal worship, basically, in Israel. And we can see this in verse 32 of chapter 16 of 1 Kings. He set up an altar for Baal in the temple of Baal that he built in Samaria. And he also made an Asherah pole and did more to provoke the Lord God of Israel, verse 33, to anger, than did all the kings of Israel before him. Now that's saying something about this Ahab. Going back to verse 31, he not only considered it trivial to commit the sins of Jeroboam, son of Nebat, but also married Jezebel, daughter of Ethbaal, king of the Sidonians, and began to serve Baal and worship him. So Ahab, just looking at these characters that we have here, Ahab and Jezebel and Elijah, Ahab is openly belligerent here, it seems, towards God. And yet, later on, we see that God actually shows him mercy. He gives him a chance when he pleads. And that says two things to me. One, that God is so very merciful, and he gives all of us a chance. He gives all of us an opportunity to change. And the second thing that I see here is Ahab's character. Because God shows him mercy, he seems like he wants to change, and yet, sitting next to Jezebel, it seems like a prime example of someone under pressure and subjecting to this peer pressure. Ahab, it doesn't seem, is a Baal follower, because he even names his sons I can't remember, I don't have in front of me the names. I have them written down, but not in front of me. But he named his sons names that had to do with God and with worship of God. So they were kind of God-centered names, and yet he set up this temple of Baal. And so it seems he doesn't reject this idea of God. He wants God in his life, but he wants Baal as well. He doesn't reject God, but rejects his instruction. And will take God when he wants him, it seems. Now, when Elijah is involved with Israel, because he's involved with Israel and then he's involved with the widow outside of Israel, when he's in Israel dealing with Ahab, it seems that he's also dealing with Jezebel. Even if it's only implied, everything he does seems to be fighting against this Jezebel or issues relating to her actions. Or dealing with something that Ahab has done because Jezebel said, you've got to do this. Emphasis, actually, to this is found, if we just flip over to chapter 21, verse 25 of 1 Kings. It says, there was never a man like Ahab who sold himself to do evil in the eyes of the Lord, urged on by Jezebel, his wife. So there's a dominance here of Jezebel. And one major reason for Elijah having to even have been there. And I wonder, if Jezebel weren't even in the picture, how Ahab would have turned out. Would he have been more like a Saul? Or would he have just been a weak, maybe, but godly king? But we have to believe that God was directing these things. So it seems that Jezebel has given all the more reason for Elijah's existence. And she not only practices this Baal worship, her own religion, but she's forcibly converting Israel. And this is what we read about Jezebel in Revelation 2, verse 20. Or about the idea of Jezebel, who Jezebel represents spiritually. But I have this against you, that you tolerate that woman Jezebel, who calls herself a prophetess, and is teaching and seducing my servants to practice immorality and eat food sacrificed to idols. Interesting that food sacrificed to idols and sexual immorality are both a part of that, which are both a part of Baal worship. And Jezebel here seems to be a personification of this, of our evil tendency of sin. And the spirit of Jezebel is stirred in to the pot of Israel here. And I can't help but think of in Proverbs, the woman of folly. And how the woman of folly leads you astray on the wrong road. And it's a highway to death. And I think that's in chapter 8 of Proverbs. But don't quote me, because better to look it up. So when Elijah's dealing with Israel, he's dealing, it seems, with Jezebel and the ramifications of her influence. I'd like to get right into this first few verses, and I don't think we're actually not going to get past the first six verses of chapter 17 tonight, because there's so much in each of these verses, and I think enough to consider for one night. Excuse me, I just have to take a drink here. So going into verse 1 of 1 Kings, we have, as I mentioned before, Elijah arriving on the scene. No kind of introduction about when he comes in, as with some of the other prophets. But he just there. Elijah the Tishbite from Tishbe in Gilead said to Ahab, "As the Lord, the God of Israel, lives, whom I serve, there will be neither dew nor rain in the next few years, except at my word." And other versions render that first part of it, because I think it's worth just looking at the origins of Elijah for a moment. It also reads, "And Elijah the Tishbite, who was of the inhabitants of Gilead, said to Ahab." Now, so it's not totally clear where this Tishbe might be, if it is a city at all. It may just refer to the fact that he was a settler whatever you call it when you're in a group and you move around, nomadic. But he was from, it seems, from the northern area of Israel, kind of between the closer to the Sea of Galilee end of the river, kind of in the Naphtali region, or maybe just east of the Jordan. In any case, I'm not a map person, so perhaps you could all get out your maps and look at the back where it says where Tishbe might be, because I have such a map in my Bible. So there are some suggestions as to where that might be, but it's not completely clear. It's a little uncertain. Something a little more relevant, I think, is his name. Now, I think sometimes we give a little too much importance to the meanings of names, in that if I call my daughter Faith, that means something. Maybe it means that I have faith, and I want to show that by naming my daughter Faith. I just took a random example. But over the years and months of calling her Faith, I don't really think of that. I think of her, right? Like with anyone, when you name them and you use the name over and over, it just becomes the person. And you don't really think of the meaning of the name a lot. And I think that perhaps this has always been true. Yet, on the other hand, meaning is there. And names were given for a reason. And the biblical names, certainly being from the Word of God, are inspired. And I think they can tell us something. And the name Elijah means Yah is God, or the Lord is my God, or my God is Jehovah. And possibly the impact of this name of Elijah was lost after years of him being Elijah. But it does say something, and it does comment on the situation of the time where Baal was God. And Baal was my God. And Baal was the powerful one. Or at least that's what Jezebel wanted in the time of Israel here. So it was a challenge, his very name. And his arrival on the scene, as I mentioned, is very abrupt and powerful, and a challenge to Ahab, because he very emphatically and matter-of-factly states God's will. He says, look, here's how it is. And there's no reason given. It doesn't say there will be no dew or rain in the next few years at my word because you did all these things wrong. It just says this is the way it is. And there's no argument from Ahab, so maybe he didn't even believe Elijah at first. But it seems like it's assumed that Ahab knows why these things are happening, or at least should have known, and that it's God's right to show mercy or not, to show compassion or not. So Ahab has gone in here, and he's set up for Baal. But God's judgment challenges any power of Baal. Baal is powerless later to bring rain. And God's judgment is actually consistent with the law and with where Israel was going. Because if you go to Leviticus 26 for a moment, there are a couple of verses in Leviticus, and actually we're going to come back to Leviticus 26 again a bit later. Leviticus 26 verses 3 and 4 say, if you walk in my statutes and observe my commandments and do them, then I will give you your rains in their season, and the land shall yield its increase, and the trees of the field shall yield their fruit. Yet there was this Jezebel factor, I'm going to call it. So this is if they observe God's decrees, his commandments. If Israel had joined themselves to God, then they would see rain. Yet with Jezebel came the poison of Jezebel brought drought, both literally and spiritually. Both literally in Israel and spiritually in Israel, and is a spiritual lesson for us today. Allowing this Jezebel factor in life is to starve oneself. Come over to Deuteronomy 11. In Deuteronomy 11, starting in at verse 13, we have again the same benefits and blessings for following God's commandments. And if you will indeed obey my commandments that I command you today, to love the Lord your God and to serve him with all your heart and with all your soul, he will give rain, verse 14. The early rain, the latter rain, all of these things he will give. He will bless. You shall eat and be full, verse 15. So, verse 16, we have a warning. Take care lest your heart be deceived, and you turn aside and serve other gods and worship them. So why does it say, take care lest your heart be deceived? Why our heart? Why not our mind? Well, because our logic, the logic of a situation is, well, God knows best, and God's way is right, so I should follow it. But that's not always what our heart says. It's not always what our emotions say. Our academic knowledge says one thing and we do something else. We know the right, but our emotion can sway us. And so that's why this warning, I think, is take care lest your heart be deceived. And there's a lot to this in terms of Ahab. Because who did he marry? He married Jezebel. And his heart is bound with Jezebel. And even if this was a political marriage, a political alliance, sure, I'll give you that. But what does God say about marriage? About who we join ourselves with? Right from the beginning, from Genesis 2:24, for this reason, shall leave your father and mother, and the two shall become one flesh. One flesh, joined together. This was the whole idea of marriage from the beginning. And God had warned Israel and Judah about who they joined themselves with. both to the kings and to the people in general. This was the ideal. But it seems exactly what Ahab set out to do anyway, is go right against what God had outlined and become one with Jezebel, with Baal. And so he's joining himself to Jezebel, and he seems to think, well, I'll join Baal and I'll join God. And wouldn't that be a great religion to have both the benefits of God and the benefits of Baal as well? And I think he tried that. He certainly had a lot of false prophets of God. But God didn't stand for this. It seems like he hadn't given up completely on God, but wanted to turn it into some kind of religion that would work with Baal worship. And the question we then ask ourselves is, what are we married to? What part of us do we know could never be one with God? What part of us do we know that we can never join with God? Because that's the part that we have to work on, isn't it? That's the part that we need to replace with something that God will want to join with. And the part that we can't marry to God is this part of us that we need to change. Verse 17 goes on in Deuteronomy 11 to say, the anger of the Lord will be kindled against you, and he will shut up the heavens, exactly what happens, so there would be no rain, and the land will yield no fruit, and you will perish quickly off the good land that the Lord is giving you. And the spiritual implications are obvious. Without sustenance spiritually, we will yield no fruit spiritually. And we will be a desert. We won't be able to grow, we won't be able to learn, and our walk will falter. Now, I'd like to contrast this with Deuteronomy 32, if we jump over to the end of Deuteronomy. And here we have Moses' song. Which is a little more on the positive side of things. And Deuteronomy 32 says at verse 1 through to 6, give ear, O heavens, and I will speak, and let the earth hear the words of my mouth. May my teaching drop as rain, my speech distill as dew, like gentle rain upon the tender grass, like showers upon the herb. For I will proclaim the name of the Lord, ascribe greatness to our God, the rock. His work is perfect, for all his ways are justice, a God of faithfulness, without iniquity. Just and upright is he. And then in verse 6, do you thus repay the Lord, you foolish and senseless people? Is he not your father who created you, who made you, and who established you? Now, as I already brought up right near the beginning, God's judgments are firm. God's judgments are final. And yet, and his mercy and compassion, although great, are at his prerogative. Now, these themes of God's judgment, his mercy, his compassion, and this rain as a feeding, as a fertilizing, as a sustenance for us from God, and the idea of joining together with him, are all themes that will recur as we keep going through these next few verses, so don't worry. If it seems like we're going to switch gears. Now, in verse 2, when we have, going back into 1 Kings 17, We have the word of the God, word of the Lord came to Elijah. And I just want to make one comment about this tiny little verse of the word of the Lord coming to Elijah. And that is that although this verse is small and seemingly insignificant and said about all the prophets of God, the fact that it's said about all the prophets of God is a huge deal, because there were so many false prophets at this time, so many priests of Baal. This was a huge deal in Elijah's day. Elijah was a true prophet of God, and God spoke to him, unlike the false prophets of the day, and not to mention all those Baal prophets. So Elijah, being a true prophet of God, listens when God says in verse 3, "Get thee hence, and turn thee eastward, and hide thyself by the brook Cherith, that is before Jordan," or the Kirith Ravine, east of Jordan, can also be rendered. Now, the interesting thing is Elijah is actually told to flee. Later, he flees because he's afraid. But here, God tells him to flee, tells him to run, to go. He's actually been told by God to do it. And sometimes we flee or run away from things because we are afraid. Often that's how people flee, isn't it? The very word flee, you kind of think, well, what are you afraid of? So how do we relate to this action of Elijah? Well, let's turn it around for a minute and ask, or I'm going to turn it around and say, we should only flee as instructed by God. And how does this work? How do we understand fleeing as instructed by God? Well, it's doing so in faith. And I think it's demonstrated in at least three aspects that I'd like to just cover here. There are three aspects, and that's consequences of flight without faith. And then faith, or flight in faith, and then flight from sin or because of sin. And I'm not talking about flight in an airplane. It's flight as in running away. The consequences, when we think of consequences, I'd like to go to Isaiah 24, because here we have an example, and that's probably how all of these will come out as examples of what I mean, and I think it'll become a little clearer that way. In Isaiah 24 and verse 18, we see we see a flight without faith. In other words, it's fleeing because of fear and it's blind. You don't know where you're going. You don't have a direction. And verse 18 says, "He who flees at the sound of terror shall fall into a pit, and he who climbs out of the pit shall be caught in the snare. For the windows of heaven are opened, and the foundations of the earth tremble." Now you can just kind of see this, and it's almost comical when you imagine, oh, someone's running along, and they're afraid, and they fall into a pit, and then you get out of the pit, and they get into a trap, and you can just see, oh, get out of the trap, and then they fall into a lake, and then you can just see it carrying on. And to me, it demonstrates this futility of man who is unable to truly save himself. Yet, we aren't in terror like this if we put our faith and trust in God. So we're not blind, and we're not fleeing, and we're not in terror if our hope is in God, because we have a purpose and we know where we're going. So the sound isn't a sound of terror to us, of faith. And so that brings us to flight in faith, which is very different from this flight of terror, because now our dependence is on God, and we trust that wherever we're going there because God is directing us. Now the example I'd like to look at is in Exodus 21. And this all does relate back to Elijah, believe me. Now, in Exodus 21, we have this issue of accidental death in the cities of refuge. Someone has done wrong. And, of course, this relates back to the mercy of God. Someone has done wrong, and God gives us opportunities. He gives us the opportunities, if we're looking, if we're there in faith, to feed or be fed by him. He gives us rain from heaven. He gives us the opportunity to rejoin our hearts with him, to realign ourselves. He gives us the opportunity, even having done the worst thing. And here is an example. Whoever strikes a man so that he dies shall be put to death. But, verse 13, if he did not lie in wait for him, but God let him fall into his hand, then I will appoint for you a place to which he may flee. And these are these cities of refuge. Numbers 35, and maybe I'll just read this to you, and you can look it up if you want. In Numbers 35, and there are actually three times in this chapter where it specifically refers to running to cities of refuge in verses 6, 11, and 15. In verse 15, it says, these six cities shall be for refuge for the people of Israel and for the stranger and for the sojourner among them. Anyone who kills any person without intent may flee there. So we get the point that God is merciful, and he's given us opportunity to flee sin, to flee our mistakes. But for what? And I think our answer is in Psalm 60, where we're told what to flee to. In Psalm 60, verse 4, we read, you have set up a banner for those who fear you, that they may flee to it from the bow, that your beloved ones may be delivered. Give salvation by your right hand and answer us. Now, David knew where his salvation was. It was not a blind terror that drove him away, or with which he flew away. No. You know what I mean. He didn't run away from things in terror. He knew his salvation was with God. It wasn't in himself. It wasn't with the people around him. It wasn't with another man. It was with God. And notice that this flight in verse 4 is going somewhere. It's going to this banner. They're fleeing to it. And it's a directed flight from the bow. Very different from a flight that's blind in terror and without faith. And we should also say, I guess, that flight from God is impossible, even though we try, which, incidentally, Jonah knew. He had other reasons to flee. He didn't flee because he thought he could get away from God. But Jonah's not our subject. Psalm 139. Psalm 139 and verse 7. And actually, we're going to look at a few verses in Psalm 139. Verse 7 to 10. Where can I go from your spirit? Where can I flee from your presence? If I go up to the heavens, you are there. If I make my bed in the depths, you are there. If I rise on the wings of the dawn and I settle on the far side of the sea, even your hand will guide me. Your right hand will hold me fast. Those are encouraging words. Emphasis that we cannot flee from God. But that very fact that we can't flee from God can be a comfort, or should be, to those of us with faith. In fact, it goes on in verse 13. You created my inmost being. You knit me together in my mother's womb. I praise you because I'm fearfully and wonderfully made. Who better to teach us, to feed us? Who better to receive the rain and the dew from and join ourselves with than one who knows us so well? Proverbs 28. Now, in Proverbs, we have a contrast of faithless flight versus righteous courage. Verse 1 of Proverbs 28, the wicked man flees, though no one pursues, but the righteous are as bold as a lion. The wicked flee, no one pursues. Again, but the righteous are bold as a lion. And the first part of that verse is the what-if scenarios. Because if we don't have our faith anywhere, even though we're not being chased, we can think of, well, what if this happens and what if that happens and then I'm in trouble. The what-if scenarios. And the second part of the verse is being able to face whatever comes our way because of the certainty that God is a guiding force in our lives and that he does direct us and he does lead us to salvation. Now, I had a couple of other examples. But I think I'm going to go straight to the New Testament references about flight from sin. And there are three verses, particularly in the New Testament, that I think you'll probably recognize as soon as I mention them. The first one is from 1 Corinthians, and it says, no temptation has seized you except that which is common to man. And God is faithful. He will not let you be tempted beyond what you can bear. But when you are tempted, will also provide a way out that you may stand up under it. That's 1 Corinthians 10, verse 13. Now, why did I pick this verse? Well, because the very next verse is verse 14. And that's not the reason I picked it. The reason I picked it is because of what it says. Therefore, my dear friends, flee from idolatry. Now, that verse on its own, I don't think is nearly as powerful as with verse 13 there. Flee from idolatry. But the context of verse 15, verse 13, helps us to quash the fear that we won't make it. Because God has told us that he's faithful toward us. He will provide a way out. And we will fail, but he will provide a way. He's provided Christ. God is our strength and our rock. And again, that comes even back from Deuteronomy, from Moses' song. God is our strength and our rock. And so with this, Paul goes on to tell us, therefore, my dear friends, flee from idolatry. Because you can. On to verses 21 and 22 of that same chapter, it says, you cannot drink the cup of the Lord and the cup of demons too. You cannot have a part both on the Lord's table and the table of demons. Are we trying to arouse the Lord's jealousy? Are we stronger than he? And the truth is, we can't have it both ways. The best of both worlds isn't a possibility, because it certainly wasn't in Ahab's time, and that was exactly what he was trying to do, extract the good from the Yahweh world and the good from the Baal world and combine it together. And those things don't combine. It's what Ahab wanted, but it didn't, it just couldn't work. And Paul is telling us right here that we can't have both. And God in the end proved his strength and Ahab's weakness. Are we trying to arouse the Lord's jealousy? Are we stronger than he? And the truth is, we're not. And we need God's strength because he can help us to overcome the weakness that is within each of us. Now, the two other verses in the New Testament, 2 Timothy 2:22, and I'll just read this one. So flee youthful passions, pursue righteousness, faith, love, peace, along with those who call on the Lord from a pure heart. And then also James 4, verse 7, submit yourselves, therefore, to God. Resist the devil, and he will flee from you. So let God feed us and reign. Let his reign touch us, and our desires will, for sin will flee away. They will certainly diminish the more that we are able to absorb absorb God's word and his truth accordingly. Now, I'd like to go back into Leviticus 26. As I mentioned near the beginning, we'd be coming back to Leviticus because here is illustrated, again, the instability of life without God's reign, without joining ourselves with God. And we see a lot of doubt in the world today, even in our developed countries. People are encountering problems that they've never encountered before, at least not in recent history. So instability of life, the unknown, doubts, they're all starting to surface a little more into even in today's life. And Leviticus 26, verse 15, if you spurn my statutes, and if your soul abhors my rules, so that you will not do all my commandments, but break my covenant, then I will do this to you. He will visit panic, verse 16. And then verse 17, I will set my face against you, and you shall be struck down before your enemies, and those who hate you shall rule over you, and you shall flee when none pursues you. That echoes back from, from the verse that we read in Proverbs. You shall flee when none pursues you. Of course, Proverbs was written later, so you probably got it from here. But it's saying no faith is a life of fear and uncertainty. And it comes up again twice more. Verse 35, as long as it lies desolate, talking about the land, it shall have rest. The rest that it did not have on your Sabbath when you were dwelling in it. Basically saying that you didn't do what you're supposed to. You didn't follow my covenant. And so verse 36, I will send faintness into your hearts. Into your hearts, send faintness. And it's the heart that we were warned to guard and to keep, because the heart can be swayed so easily. The sound of a driven leaf shall put them to flight. Now there's terror, isn't there? And they shall flee as one flees from the sword, and shall fall when none pursues. There it is again. They shall stumble over one another as if to escape a sword, though none pursues. You shall have no power to stand before your enemies. Now, I'd like to close and it looks like I won't have quite the amount of time that I thought I was going to have, even with the extra bit, to finish up all the way to verse 6. But perhaps the best way to finish is on a positive note from Isaiah 51. It seems my voice is running away with me anyway. I'm not sure where it's fleeing to or why, but Isaiah 51 and verse 11, "And the ransom of the Lord shall return and come to Zion with singing, and everlasting joy shall be upon their heads. They shall obtain gladness and joy, and sorrow and sighing shall flee away." Everything about Leviticus applies to us spiritually. If we spurn God, then we spurn the tools to counter sin. But if we embrace him, if we join ourselves to him and not with the world of Ahab, then there is a certainty about our hope. And it grounds us and it helps us to focus. Ahab had a very poor start. And it was made more difficult by joining himself to Jezebel. And he was intent on joining the world of Baal. And what did that bring on? It brought drought. God didn't send the rain. So he starved himself. Starved himself in a more important way spiritually. He had nothing. If we can prevent our hearts from running away with us and join ourselves to our God, he will provide for our needs. He will help us to grow, to flee from sin and escape, and to reside with him without fear. And then we will know this true joy where sorrow and sighing will flee away.